We need to be able to contact someone, and we need to be able to be confident that that person is that person and lives at that address in that congressional district and has a phone number that's connected that we can reach them on. Like, those are the key elements for us.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. My guest today is Ben Lazarus. Ben runs the polling operation at Target Smart, the voter data and technology and associated services company that works with Democrats and allied organizations. Ben came to Target Smart after working as a Democratic pollster at Myers Research and as political director at the Atlas Project. I was interested to hear about Ben's career and what's happening with polling at Target Smart and at that company more generally. So, first my sponsor, then my interview with Ben Lazarus at Target Smart.
What do Blue State, Sierra Club, and Indivisible have in common? They all use Civic Shout to grow email lists that raise money like clockwork, and now, so can you. Instead of vaporizing money with Facebook ads or burning bridges with spam, a new wave of digital directors are helping Democrats and nonprofits acquire opt-ins and nail their monthly goals with Civic Shout. Environmental action called Civic Shout, a wildly better way to grow your email list. And Clarify Agency saw a 200% return on ad spend in just 2 months. Head to civicshout.com/partners to learn more and schedule a demo. That's civicshout.com/partners.
Ben, would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Yeah, sure. First, thanks for having me, Nathaniel. I really appreciate the opportunity to join you today. So yeah, my name is Ben Lazarus. I'm a pollster. I have been working in Democratic politics since 2007, and most of that time in public opinion research as a pollster. My first campaign ever was the 2007 Virginia Coordinated Campaign. And I ended up there through kind of happenstance. I was kind of aimless coming out of college, and friend of the family, knew a guy who knew a guy who knew a lady who knew a guy, that kind of thing to connect me with a guy named Dan Kelly, who was the field director for the Virginia Coordinated Campaign and still works in our space today.
That sounds like a really unfair use of connections.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And listen, that's to some extent, that's politics. And, you know, you kind of take what you get. And I've been pretty fortunate in kind of falling into things, honestly. I'm under no illusions that I haven't been really lucky and fortunate.
I was kind of joking because of the long chain that you were describing.
Yeah. Well, it was Herb Berkowitz to Kirk Sander, Kirk Sander to Dan Kelly. And I guess my father was in there somewhere too. So there's maybe one other.
You have to walk through the doors that are visible.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's right. And I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was spinning pizzas at a place called Gourmet Pizza Kitchen in Tampa, Florida, where my parents live and where I grew up. Didn't really know what I wanted to do. I was living at home. I was maybe a little depressed about it, honestly. And then this opportunity to go work on a political campaign came about, and I had no idea really what that even meant. It was a field organizer. I didn't know what a field organizer did. I interviewed, and I learned kind of on the interview what the job was. And it sounded like a lot of fun and something that would, be in alignment with my values. And I cared a lot about politics. I studied political science in college. I did a minor in applied statistics as well. So I kind of always knew that the nexus of data and politics was something that interested me. I didn't know exactly what I was going to do with it. So this was an opportunity, and I kind of just, packed up my car and drove from Florida to exurban Washington, D.C., where I worked on a state Senate race in Stafford, Virginia. The Virginia Coordinated that year was all about state ledge because there wasn't anything else at the top of the ticket. I worked on an island state Senate race because there were no other kind of coterminous districts that were a part of that election. So I worked for a gentleman named Albert Pollard, who was a House of Delegates member who was running for the state Senate. Not very competitive district, but he was a different kind of candidate. He represented a very conservative part of the district and kind of put the district in play as a result. And that was a transformative moment in my life because it got me into politics. I met my wife on that race. It ultimately was the bridge to working in consulting as well. Albert's pollster was a gentleman named Andrew Myers, who I got to listen in on some of the polling calls as a field organizer, which was really cool to me, and hear what was going on kind of that side. You know, I was marshaling volunteers and knocking on doors every day, and really a lot of what is the, I thought of it as the front line of democracy when I did the work. I thought it was really cool, and I still feel like it was a tremendously valuable experience for me as a pollster to get to talk to people one-on-one and hear their stories and what they cared about. And I think it was an entree for me in terms of listening and asking questions, which is still what I feel like is the basis of my work these days. That was tremendously formative. And then it was also the bridge to working in consulting and polling, because after that election, I bounced around to a couple of other campaigns. I went to Iowa and I worked for John Edwards for about 7 weeks before the Iowa caucuses, right after Thanksgiving. Maybe it was a little less than 7 weeks, right after Thanksgiving up through the Iowa caucuses in early 2008. I was in Burlington, Iowa. Caucus night itself was like still one of the coolest experiences of my life. It was exhilarating in every way, really, really kind of connected to presidential politics in the most profound way if you're in Iowa. So that was really cool. And then Albert, the candidate who I'd mentioned, he actually lost that first race by about 300 votes. So that one really stung, but he had the opportunity to run in a special election in February for his old House of Delegates seat in rural northern neck of Virginia. So I went back there, and my then girlfriend, Jessica, now wife, we both went back to the northern neck. The gang came back together from the previous year's state Senate race, and we won that special election. That was another sprint. So it was kind of this long slog in 2007 and then two short sprints. And I was really exhausted from campaigning at that point. And so looked to the DC scene and more stable jobs that were in one place. And I was kind of lucky enough to come across a job posting for Myers Research and Strategic Services, which was, again, Albert's pollster. So again, I kind of had this fortuitous bridge where like I knew someone. And I had a little bit of a gateway into that world. It was a cycle position, so seasonal hire, junior research analyst job that I did in 2008 at Myers Research. And I did a good enough job that they kept me on after the cycle. I ended up working there for 7 years. So I was at Myers Research until through the 2014 cycle. It was a really small operation. At no point did we have any more than like 7 or 8 employees. We would kind of grow ebb and flow on year, off year with seasonal hires. Because of the size of the operation, I had kind of really lucky opportunities to be really close to client work at a really kind of early stage in my polling career that I think equipped me to kind of understand things and not have the kind of degrees of separation that frequently occur in larger firms, right? So like it was principal, then me staffing calls rather than the principal and then like a vice president, then a senior analyst, and then me. There just wasn't that level of organization or size of team to enable that. And so I was like on all the calls and staffing all the work and writing tons of surveys and writing tons of memos and doing lots of background research and learning about the data side and the sampling side, the survey science side, the telephony side, the communication side. I talk about how polling is just this tremendously interdisciplinary work. It's like all of these different things piled on top of each other, and you don't have to necessarily be a super expert in any one of them, but it's important that you're kind of good at all of them in terms of psychology and statistics and communication and some data analysis. Having some sense of all of those things is like really important, I think, to being a good pollster. And so I got a great kind of 360 view on that in my work at Myers and got to be really close to client work really early in my career. And that set me up for a lot of success. 7 years, 3.5 cycles, I guess. And we did a fair amount of Virginia work in the off year. And so every year was pretty busy. And Andrew and his partner, Lauren Spangler, has her own polling firm now. It's called Searchlight. She's great. You should talk to her. They were really my mentors, and I learned everything I really know about the business and the work from them, and got a lot of opportunities to kind of cut my teeth in state legislative polling in particular. Andrew and Lauren had been at the DLCC. They had been at Greenberg Quinlan Rosner Research and then kind of spun off this interesting practice called, so it was Myers Research, and then it was Myers Research Strategic Services. because it was this first foray that the DLCC really invested in state legislative polling at scale. And so they really kind of unlocked the secret sauce for figuring out how caucus programs can do polling in an affordable and effective way. And I got to really be on the front lines of that, which was really, my heart is still in state ledge work as a result. And it's really what I consider my specialty as a pollster. Kind of cut my teeth in that. And then after the 2014 cycle, I kind of needed a break. I left polling for a year. I joined an organization called the Atlas Project as their political director, which is no longer in existence, but was a software and research hub for the labor movement. And I ran a team of political analysts who wrote a lot of content about how to win battleground states. We had kind of the first chance to run a team in that role. And my first chance to really kind of develop network in the DC scene, I got to sit in on the America Votes political directors meetings in that role and meet all the people who are doing lots of really great, important organizing work across the labor movement and the progressive movement, and kind of spread my wings outside of the states a little bit, which was really cool and a great opportunity for me. And then about a year after that, I received a call from a colleague who I knew who was at Target Smart. Target Smart was looking for someone to pilot a new polling program that they were going to be running out of the company. And they were looking for somebody who was really similar to my description. And they said, hey, you know anybody? And I said, that sounds kind of cool. Tell me more. And so in that capacity, I got to meet Tom Bonnier, who was this, at the time, the CEO of Target Smart, who kind of pitched me on this idea of he had some clients that he was doing some polling work for as a carryover from his work at Clarity Campaign Labs. And he had done a lot of work around redistricting in New Jersey in particular. So he had a fair number of clients in New Jersey, and he couldn't really manage those polling clients and run this data company. So they really needed some capacity to staff these customers and then hopefully grow a polling business inside of this voter file company. That was the genesis of the polling team at Target Smart. And that's where I've been ever since. So going on 7 years at this point, we've been doing just that polling practice, public opinion research practice that's nested inside this larger data and technology company at Target Smart, which is, of course, our industry's leader in voter file data, making that voter data available to campaigns and causes at every level of the ballot. Our team is doing something a little different. We're providing more strategic services to similar sets of clients, more straight up consulting and polling focused than the kind of data sales and data licensing that's the kind of core business of Target Smart. That's the quick bio in 10 minutes or so.
Well, thanks for that. I guess we are done.
Seems all right, like cool.
You told the story, you know, what more do we need? but a few questions that occur to me. Maybe the first one is the most important, which is, as you were talking through this, and you mentioned that you were spinning pizzas at one point, I realized that every time we try to make pizzas at home with the dough, we have a heck of a time getting those things flat. And I wondered if you still have expertise related to that, because I certainly don't. What's the secret there to turning something that for me just keeps crunching back down to a ball almost? It's like, they're so elastic and they don't want to be flat. What have I missed here?
This was not the only time I spun pizzas. I made pizzas at three different restaurants. So you got to kind of get the toss is overrated. The toss is like just kind of fancy.
That's just showing off.
That's just showing off.
I'm not even going to learn the toss. Yeah, I don't want to show
unnecessary.
Off.
No, yeah. But you got to go from the inside out, and you kind of, there's a motion where you, and podcast is a great vehicle for this, because I'm doing something with my hands right now, where you got to kind of like have this circular motion where you start from the inside and you come out and you go inside out, inside out, inside out. That takes the gluten in the dough and it expands it so that it will keep kind of contracting, but you just got to be patient. Inside out, inside out, inside out, process, 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 and eventually it'll stretch out. Don't use a rolling pin. That's the worst thing you can do.
Yeah. Often I will try to find a connection between something someone learned early in their career like that and what they do right now. I'm struggling a little bit. Can you make any?
To making pizza and well, I guess
making polls. I mean, you know,
Well, I worked at a bar in college called Dominick's. I went to the University of Michigan and I worked at Dominick's. Anybody who's been to Ann Arbor probably knows Dominick's. And it's only open in the summer months and they do like sangria and other seasonal drinks. And it's kind of a raucous crowd. People go in the afternoon. I started on dishes and it was, I mean, Nathaniel was trifling. Like it was gross. Like these, this, it was just like the nastiest of the nasty. And I now say, if, you know, I was able to wash dishes at Dominick's, I can wash any dish now. I'm completely a nerd to any kind of disgusting thing. And I think about the blocking and tackling of the work that I do and that my team does in polling. And a lot of it's not glamorous at all. Our work is really detail oriented. And there are like thousands and thousands of places where you can screw it up and where you can make a mistake that can be really costly to your business, to your customers, to the time and the effort that's been put into to generating the research. And so there's a lot of detail and grittiness, I think, that goes into polling that probably most folks would have no idea to even think about. And having had that kind of time under tension of having worked in a small shop and doing everything, I kind of connect back to those dishes I did at Dominick's. Like, it's not glamorous, but it's tremendously important in terms of setting the foundation for the work that I do now. I'm blessed. I've got a great team that does some of that stuff for me so I can concentrate on developing the business and servicing the clients and leadership. And those are really the three main hats that I wear now. Having done all of that stuff, I can still do it. I still do it sometimes from time to time when we're really busy and I gotta jump in and roll my sleeves up. And I think that there's no task that's too small has always been an ethos of the places I've worked. I think it's like really important to staying close to the work and connected to it and doing good work for the customers at the end of the day.
I think you aced that connection. I do think that there's something about paying your dues early on in your career in various fashions, whether that's the entry-level work in the actual area or just understanding what the jobs are that many people do, not just at the beginning of their career, but maybe for a whole career, that helps you understand the country better. And that can't hurt if you're looking at public opinion.
I mean, I completely agree. And I kind of go back to that field organizer job where I was knocking on 100 doors a night and having hopefully 25 to 30 conversations, depending on the answer rate. And not all of those were meaningful conversations. A lot of times folks are just trying to get you to leave their doorstep as quickly as possible. But a lot of them were. You find connection however you can find connection. I've always been a really curious person. I've always been a big question asker. My field director on my first campaign once called me Questions McSay My Name, because I would always say his name and then ask a question. That kind of baseline curiosity is the most important thing to have in public opinion research. We want to know what makes people tick, what makes them change their mind, what makes them change their behavior, what makes them not change their mind or change their behavior, what's different or interesting about that, that we can surface to actually help folks make decisions, and knowing the right question to ask and having a kind of baseline understanding of like what makes people tick and what's important and not, that's like absolutely critical to the work. Recognizing that most people are not political, most people don't care about this stuff like we do, that is the fundamental baseline challenge we all have to kind of figure out. And it's only getting harder and harder as it's a more fractured environment in terms of reaching people and getting messages to them that like that kind of baseline, like people don't really care about this stuff. They have lives, they're busy, they're stressed, they have families, they have jobs, they have interests and hobbies, and politics is so tangential and so foreign to most normal people. We just kind of have to bake all of that in, and that what we're doing is really, really affecting things on the margins. They're really important margins because our elections are so close and so tightly contested that those margins are super duper important. But I think like recognizing the limitations that baseline level of this is not a salient thing in most people's lives, right, is just really important for us to always be coming back to. And when you have a conversation with a voter in a focus group, you're almost always grounded in that. You're almost always figuring that out very, very quickly, that your expectations for what people probably should know and probably don't know are like tend to be worlds apart, right? And that's not on them. That's on us, you know, as practitioners in this field, as communicators, as leaders. It's on us to make things break through in ways that actually impact people and that they want to listen to. but they're not paying attention to it. Like that's so important to recognize, right? To kind of start as the thesis.
Yeah, it actually makes me think about, I share some of that curiosity, and I had a summer I spent canvassing for a PIRG where I think I exercised that curiosity and worked on ways of making connections to people who didn't off the bat want to necessarily engage with me. And I think even in doing a podcast now that I'm still utilizing some of what I started on back in those days, and sounds somewhat related. Other things that occurred to me as you were walking through your biography is, you know, anyone who worked for John Edwards, because he ended up being personally disappointing on some levels, I think when that happens, like I was very attracted to and tried to help Gary Hart in the 1980s, who I thought would have been as good a president as we could find among our politicians, but who it now turns out was set up, and his campaign fell apart on a somewhat crappy scandal, so small compared to the things that happen today. But that affected my political outlook, having adopted someone to follow and then having the country spit him back out. How did the sort of John Edwards post-campaign meltdown out of politics hit you?
Yeah, I mean, it was very disappointing because you're making very little money when you're a field organizer on a presidential campaign in Iowa. I think I made like $1,300 a month or something like that. One time we very depressingly in our field office like calculated our hourly wage, which I do not recommend aspiring field organizers out there. Do not do this. Bad idea. It's just going to be depressing. We were making nothing. When you put that kind of effort into the work, you're not doing it for the money. You're doing it because you believe in the work, and whether it's the person you believe in or it's the cause that you believe in. I was very much inspired by John Edwards when I worked for him. His message about the two Americas really, really spoke to me. I think he was one of the first Democrats to talk about poverty in a real way and to submit to the Democratic primary electorate an agenda that was acutely focused on alleviating poverty. I think his agenda was largely adopted by President Obama as he ended up in that pretty contentious and long primary with Hillary Clinton after John Edwards dropped out. So I think there was like a lot to be proud of in terms of the cause set that kind of drew me to the work and the conversations I had with, you know, Iowa caucus goers. It would be totally disingenuous of me to say I wasn't like very disappointed, saddened, hurt, betrayed. The stuff around John Edwards' affair was first reported by the National Enquirer. I don't know if you remember this. We all thought it was a joke, right? Because it was the National Enquirer. It wasn't a serious publication, but man, did they have the scoop.
And it seemed like he had a marriage that on the outside looked like a real marriage.
Right. Yeah, totally. It was kind of brutal, but at the same time, like, I don't think.
These are still human beings. That's the interesting thing is like politicians are all too human, as George Stephanopoulos wrote in his book.
Yeah, that's right. They're still human beings. People are flawed. People make mistakes. This was like a pretty egregious set of mistakes and rightly would disqualify someone from being the president. So yeah, it hurt, but I met a lot of great friends on that campaign, made a lot of great connections on that campaign. Like I said, caucusing was one of the coolest experiences of my life. It was absolutely exhilarating and I wouldn't trade that for anything. And just having that experience of being in the weeds in Iowa in January, driving my Florida tagged stick shift front wheel drive car up a icy slope and getting stuck, you know, and living in a what was basically a halfway house with another field organizer. I didn't have to pay any rent for that place, by the way, which was nice. I didn't have any money, so that was helpful. I still think of my memories in Iowa like fondly, despite what happened to John Edwards and what came out about John Edwards. I can hold both of those things and be super disappointed and angry, but also like grateful for the experience.
A lot of people who work for a polling firm for a while, I mean, I saw that your title was vice president by the end. They end up becoming partners in that or forming another polling firm with other people, or circulating sort of in the small number of proprietors world of political consulting and public opinion, you seem to have taken a route. I've seen this route before. People who work for some of the big panel survey groups or other basically data providers out there. How do you think about that choice to go with a firm that had other products and other strengths and is a business outside of polling compared to what might have been?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know if I would ascribe a huge amount of intentionality behind the decision, to be honest. Like I said, kind of at the beginning of the podcast, I've really fallen into things, Nathaniel. I've gotten so lucky in terms of the situations I found myself in and the opportunities that I've been presented with. I think I've made smart decisions about jumping on those opportunities when they come to me. And Target Smart was this really interesting, unique opportunity to be to kind of be in something at the ground level and not have a clear sense of exactly what it was going to be, and to have support from a larger company that was interested in doing this thing that wasn't exactly positive what it was going to materialize into, where there wasn't a huge amount of pressure for it to materialize into anything in particular. To me, that was really attractive because it provided not a huge amount of pressure, but also an opportunity space to grow something and to build something. One of the things that Tom pitched me on when I interviewed with him was that, like, one of the company's key precepts is that we let the people closest to the problem solve the problems, and we have a pretty strong aversion to micromanagement. And that ethos resourced me to go do what I wanted to do and not have a huge amount of interference, to have resources, to have team, to have capacity built in to help me, but to not necessarily direct exactly what I was supposed to do with this thing, but to have a few clients, to have the opportunity to bring in more clients, do good work, to relearn the work. Honestly, I've been away from it for a year. After leaving a polling firm that I'd been at for a long time, I was not terribly interested in working for another pollster and not being the principal for a lot of reasons. And so I found that the ability to have less pressure, but have this sort of blank canvas as to what this could be, was really appealing to me. And it continues to be, you know, continues to be a really great situation for me in which I have opportunities to grow a business while having resources and support to keep that business strong and to generate opportunities that are really different than what most other polling firms do and or can do based on the connection to the data, the connection to the broader progressive and tech ecosystem that Target Smart is so central to, and helped me learn a lot about data and about what voter files are, how they're connected to the work that folks do on the ground, and how we can kind of walk that back to the polling in ways that are like really interconnected and therefore I think fundamentally actionable. And so I feel like I've gotten a opportunity to kind of establish our own little brand of polling, of public opinion research inside of a data company, which is a unique thing, right? It's not exactly the same as how my competitors might be going about doing business. I found all those things to be attractive and fun and exciting. And at the same time, the company is a really nice place to work. People are really nice here. And generally, there is that vibe of not meddling with the people who are the closest to the clients and letting them come up with like good ideas and really, you know, stellar customer service to make sure that they're happy and that they're equipped to win. That's been my journey at Target Smart and sort of what my decision set was. Again, it was sort of this opportunity that came along and I wasn't necessarily looking to leave the Atlas Project at the time, but it was too cool of an opportunity to pass up. And it's definitely evolved over time into something that's more than it was originally pitched to me as in terms of like how our business has grown and our team has grown and our client set has grown and the type of work that we do has expanded. The types of races that we take on and clients we take on have morphed over time in really exciting ways that have always kind of kept me intellectually challenged and continued to be excited about the work.
I'm going to ask you more about that in a second, but I want to just ask one question before about Atlas Project. I had interviewed Steve Rosenthal, who I think was the founder of that quite some time ago. I tracked it a little bit after he opened it up. What happened? Why did it stop going forward? And is that a substantial loss to not have it, or did something take its place?
The Atlas project was something that was sort of a forerunner of other things that have come into our space in terms of technology tools that are more private utilities that folks can buy, as opposed to what the Atlas project's model was, more of this kind of public utility for the movement. That the best analog is probably Catalyst, right? Where Catalyst is this trust that was seeded by a number of institutions in the movement and takes on customers outside of those seeding organizations, but it still receives a fair amount of its support from those big institutions and is a big asset to those big institutions in the labor movement and kind of across the progressive space as well. And so Atlas had the intention to service that same set of organizations. And I think it did it really well. Atlas was largely aligned with the Hillary Clinton campaign in 2008. So coming out of 2008, I think it had to think through what it was going to do with President Obama, not a President Clinton. It really pivoted at that point to doing more software development as opposed to more content generation. The original iteration of the Atlas project was writing these roadmap reports, which continued when I was there. And that was really my job, was I was working on the roadmap report piece of the organization, where they were these like really long form, deep guides that would help someone who didn't know much about a battleground state get up to speed really quickly on that battleground state's culture, how to think about considering targeting in that state, how to think about the various forms of communication that are used in that state, so that somebody who's, you know, at a national labor organization who's getting dropped into that state can get up to speed really quickly and be and operating in it at pace. And so it continued to develop those roadmap reports and then also added this online toolkit, which I think was ahead of its time, really, in terms of the various data streams that it brought together, public and private, to just create a lot of insights into data and information streams all kind of in one place. I don't have a good answer. I don't really necessarily know. I left about a year before the Atlas project went away. And I'm sure that there were, you know, good business reasons and other reasons for why it stopped operating at that point in time.
So now you're at Target Smart. You seem to be one of those people who stays with a job for appreciable amount of time, which I always kind of appreciate when I see that on a resume these days. It's not that common. Can you give me a sense of your part, the polling part of Target Smart? How big is that? How big is that compared to the whole firm in like employees and contribution to the business? So I can understand that first.
Yeah, sure. So our team has 8 people on it right now. The company overall has somewhere around 70 people. We are one part of a kind of broader umbrella of service offerings that the company offers to various campaigns and causes in the space that's kind of separate and apart, sometimes connected to, but generally separate and apart from the data sales. The data sales and the data licensing, Target Smart builds a national voter file. We make it available to campaigns and causes at every level of the ballot in all different kinds of ways, whether that's analytics firms that are building models on our data, or digital advertising agencies that are purchasing digital advertising based on our data, pollsters who are buying poll samples to drive their polls using our data, organizing campaigns, labor campaigns, membership organizations that are matching their data to ours to enhance it, all kinds of different use cases for our data. And then our work is more focused on services. We provide public opinion research services, my team, the research solutions team. And then we have a team that provides services that are more kind of catch-all targeting and data consulting. That's run by a gentleman named Chris Brill, who's been at the company for some time. They work on various and sundry path to victory projects, profiling projects to give a sense of the kind of landscape of a political movement in a particular place or region. They draw maps, so they help organizations and legislative bodies on redistricting. All different kinds of cool stuff with data is the way I like to describe Chris's team. My team also does some really fun work in the analytics space. So Target Smart, as part of our data offerings, as a public utility to our data customers, we build and maintain a lot of micro-targeting models, 30 to 50 micro-targeting models at any given point in time that All of our data customers have access to basically as a right for purchasing the data. So that's anything from predicting an individual voter's likelihood to be a Democrat or vote for Joe Biden or support specific issues and be on one side of an issue versus the other side of an issue to their propensity to participate in an upcoming election to lots of other interesting stuff that we can model and make predictions about. And those models are frequently built using large scale surveys. And so my team works really closely with the analytics team to collect that data, particularly for projects that are more custom in nature. Those kind of utility models that exist for our data customers are sort of one piece of the business, but then we have other customers that come to us who have specific problems and tool sets they're trying to develop that we'll build custom models for. So like a ballot measure campaign that wants to predict individual level support to vote yes on a specific ballot measure, or a campaign that wants to build a candidate support model. They have a different kind of Democrat who they surmise might have different types of supporters than a replacement Democrat would, where a national model might be the right tool. State level turnout models, state level candidate support models for state legislative elections. We build a lot of those as well. So we work with those customers to help them conceptualize the tool sets that they're trying to build and they're going to be using to implement their voter contact programs. And we work really closely with the data science folks on our analytics team to make sure they get the data they need to train those models. That's definitely not anything I ever did at Myers. It's a very different piece of the work that I find really interesting. Honestly, marrying the two has been a passion of mine. Building micro-targeting models is this really interesting exercise in value proposition. It's really expensive. You have to have a lot of data to build a model that has any kind of accuracy or precision. And therefore, you really have to have a lot of money that you're going to spend to use that model for it to make sense to build it in the first place. So it's this interesting chicken or the egg question. What I've spent a fair amount of time thinking through is like, how can we help folks make their investment in public opinion research really sing and really kind of provide value adds that translate that data into the ability to actually go and talk to individual voters. And so particularly in the state legislative space, we do a lot of polling for legislative caucus programs where we're not just polling for one campaign, but we're polling for 7 to 8 to 10 to 15 campaigns across a state legislative battleground. And so instead of having just 400 interviews from one state legislative poll, we've got upwards of 3,000 or 4,000 interviews for that state legislative campaign caucus committee. And so at that point, we have like plenty of data to go out and build a micro-targeting model, and we don't have to spend any extra money on it because we already have the data. And so figuring out those opportunities to kind of build value for customers and take the investment they've already made in understanding what people think about things, where they're leaning in elections, how they're approaching issues, how they're approaching messaging and Democrats in general, and walking that over to a micro-targeting model that allows folks to then go and find individual voters who fit a profile and serve them ads and serve them digital ads, send them direct mail, knock on their door. I think that's a really powerful tool set that really kind of marries something that can feel kind of esoteric, which is like a public opinion research poll, right? Soccer moms is like the archetype that we talk about. Well, we can actually go and find individual Lindas and Judys to communicate with rather than this kind of high-minded idea of an archetypal target. And I think being a pollster at TargetSmart specifically has unlocked the opportunity to do that in a really meaningful way for my customers and for our customers more broadly.
When you're talking all about all of that, that's a very broad portfolio of different activities inside TargetSmart, and which there is competition from different firms in different parts of your offering. So like you would, like if you're talking about the voter data, we would have Catalyst, you would have other repositories of voter information, L2, citizen data in the democracy space. It's a lot. Then with the modeling, I know Catalyst has those sort of things. The analytics firms, you mentioned Clarity, would be building models also. Of course, you have the standard polling firms, you have things like YouGov, which have big panels, work polling in a different way. They have their own YouGov Blue. Well, there's a lot of potential clients and there's a lot of offerings. How do you fit yourself into the competitive environment? How do you think about TargetSmart generally and your part of it specifically?
we have different verticals where we have different markets that we're competing in, right? And I think one of the cool things about TargetSmart is we're quite a diversified company where we've got all of these different lines of business that are providing value to our customers in different ways. And sometimes we're cross-selling where we're providing multiple services and multiple data products to our customers. And sometimes we're just in one of those lanes, right? My core competitors tend to be other polling firms, right? But at the same time, those polling firms are buying poll sample from TargetSmart all the time.
Does that ever drive them to use a different data vendor if they feel like you're a competitor?
I don't think we've necessarily felt that. I think that's a testament to the quality of our data, which I can say is really high. I use it all the time. We use it every week with all the polls that we put into the field. I think it creates somewhat of a competitive advantage for us in the space in that we sit on top of the voter file. We have really easy access to it. TargetSmart, one of the big investments we've made in our data is to like triple, quadruple source mobile numbers, right? So we have a huge repository of cell phone numbers. We were one of the very early adopters knowing that this is coming, right? Like folks are moving away from the landline. Everyone's going to have a mobile device. No one's going to be using a landline in the next 10 years, right? Very few use them now. We've got access to all this great cell phone data that we use for all different kinds of things in my space and that our, obviously, practitioners are using for all different kinds of things in their spaces. That's a question for other pollsters is like, is it worth using what might be inferior data because of our kind of cross-pollination of business, right?
And you're only one of so many pollsters. It's not, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And we, our polling business, our poll sample business, as far as I know, is quite strong still, right? And we sell poll samples to, dozens of public opinion research shops across the movement. Some still use other vendors. I don't necessarily know if I've heard any feedback that any have left our portfolio because they're mad that we're also doing polling.
Do you think there's a substantial difference between a poll sample drawn from Catalyst and one drawn from you?
There are objective measures of data quality. I don't want to speak ill of a competitor in that space, but I am very happy with the quality of the TargetSmart voter file. Our voter data in general has a competitive edge over a lot of the space. We have the most updates in terms of getting new raw voter files from source, meaning secretaries of state, and the cadence of our update schedule is incredibly high. Our team works incredibly hard to be constantly updating the voter file in all of these states. We have really strong relationships with exogenous data vendors to make sure our data is up to date in terms of what we're able to match to the commercial data set. And then we bring in all kinds of other really important data sources, particularly around contact information, that I think gives us a little bit of a leg up in terms of having people matched to phone numbers, matched to addresses that are reliable. And for a pollster, that's really the key is we need to be able to contact someone and we need to be able to be confident that that person is that person and lives at that address in that congressional district and has a phone number that's connected that we can reach them on. Like those are the key elements for us. And when you're talking about a higher cadence of updates and more sourcing and better sourcing and big investment in sourcing, all of those things come together to create a file that's really good for everything, right? Whether that's doing a text message program, a phone bank program, a Canvas program, a direct mail program, a targeted digital ad, or a poll, it's all baked in the data, right? And if the data is good, the output's going to be good, good in, good out. And so I think our data is really, really strong and other pollsters come to us because of that. I think that's one of our big value propositions too, is that, most other pollsters have to pass along the cost of buying a poll sample to their customers. And we don't have to do that because we sit on top of the data and we already own it.
How about on the analytics side? How do you see the competitive space there?
I've been at this firm for 7 years now, and I'm still figuring it out. It's more of a foreign business than polling. I feel like I really understand the landscape on polling, and I think the analytics landscape is newer and it's changing more rapidly. And I think that the barriers to entry for buying custom analytics are really high. It's expensive. And so the marketplace tends to be smaller for who can afford it and who is investing in it. And so the competition, therefore, is like pretty fierce as a result. I would say it's, for me, more challenging it's definitely like a part of the calculus. You know, we have goals for generating business around analytics and custom analytics. And some of that is from working with existing clients, and some of it is finding new clients. But it's really hard. Yeah. It's understanding where the market is, how to price things, how to think about whether the juice is worth the squeeze. One of the things I really pride myself on is when I tell a customer not to buy something because I don't think it's worth it. I think that if anything, it's important for your pollster to be honest with you. Like that is like giving an honest read on the data, an honest read on the value proposition. How well are you doing? What should you say? What shouldn't you say? If we're not telling you the truth, then we're really doing something wrong. And I think that even comes down to like what we can sell you and what we should sell you and shouldn't sell you. You know, frequently I find that when someone comes in like a cold email to our sales email asking about a model, that my answer is, I don't think you should do that because I don't think it's worth it. It's going to be too expensive. You're not spending enough money in your program to warrant the efficiencies that you would get from such a targeting exercise.
Maybe I don't understand one thing about that, which is once you've built a model and you've sold it to a client, is there any extra cost to you? Why would you make it pricey to price out a particular type of potential consumer of it? Isn't there a way, if that's valuable, to put that in front of somebody in a way that is affordable?
So think about it in two ways, right? We have some models that folks already pay for through their subscription to Target Smart Data, however they're buying Target Smart Data. And we don't add anything to our data costs. If you're going to license, like let's say we have our data integrated with Van, right, through a product called Smart Van. So outside of the party infrastructure, if you're not a candidate campaign, if you're a C3, C4, super PAC labor union, and you want to have a van, you can buy what's called a Smart Van. And it's at the state level, county level, congressional district level, national level. You can buy that organizing tool and Target Smart Data is preloaded in it. And with that, you'll have access to all of our national models and all of the scores that come along with that. And that's a community utility that anybody can get access to who uses Target Smart Data. Same thing, if you're an analytics firm, you would get access to those fields of those models. If you're purchasing against our data for digital advertising through our new media buying platform, all of those scores and audiences are already there. You can use them. You don't have to pay anything extra for them. That investment's already been made. The other way to think about it is for a custom project where a client comes to us and says, hey, we have this specific need that is not met by your national modeling offerings, and we want to commission you to do it differently and separately. That's where the expense comes in, because it's something that's not fully baked in and where we have to go out and collect a lot of data to build that model. And if the customer is commissioning us to do that, there's a presumption of like data security, data privacy, and ownership, where like we're not going to share that model with anybody else off the street. That model's owned by that customer that commissioned it. So there's a kind of cost to entry for that client that wants to commission us to build something custom. And, you know, frequently the party committees, the really large spenders, they're going to refresh their models every 2 years and spend a fair amount of money doing that because they're spending a lot of money on program. It's really worth it to them to have new models that are trained on new data that are specific to their needs and kind of customized to the program that they're going to be running.
Sometimes they're bringing that in-house these days. Have you seen much in that regard?
I think that's happening more and more at the really large party committees, like the DNC, for example, that they're expanding their analytics offerings. You know, obviously, the Biden campaign has a very sophisticated and large data analytics operation, and they're doing a lot of that in-house. Again, it's really about buying power, because if you've got the capacity in-house and the budget in-house to do it, it makes sense to do it. You're not paying a markup from a vendor to do it for you, but that does take a lot of infrastructure. It takes a lot of staff. It takes a lot of, and then it takes like a large internal budget to do that. It's happening. I don't think it's hugely widespread. I think most of it's still getting outsourced to vendors, but it is happening.
Which happens more from the perspective of your polling part? Business comes to you from the other parts of Target Smart, or business goes to other parts of Target Smart from you?
That's a great, another great question. I would say that it's a relatively even mix. And there is maybe not as much as you would think in terms of either direction. Our business is unique to the rest of the company. And while we certainly get some opportunities to upsell data customers on polling services. Polling is really expensive. It typically needs a really clear goal and issue set and outcome set that's like predetermined by a budget that's been written months in advance. And so if somebody comes in to buy access to a data list, the odds that they also need a $30,000 poll are pretty low, right? On the same side, most of our customers are candidate campaigns. Not all of them, but I'd say our modal customer is a Democrat who's running for the state legislature, running for Congress, running for a county level position, running for mayor. And those candidates and their candidate campaigns are almost exclusively obtaining voter data through Democratic state party apparatus. That's where you go. If you're a candidate, you go to the state party to get your data. We don't sell it to you.
Are you still part of that voter file process? There was a point where Target Smart was. Is that still the case?
Yeah. One of our key partners is the co-op. It's a cooperative of all the state parties that come together to basically work with Target Smart to enhance voter file data in almost every state. It's a critical partnership for us. It's one of the things that makes our data really good. The cross-selling is like less common than you'd think. I'd say the cross-selling is most common on the services front, right? Where like we're providing one service and we might have some ideas of other services that our customers might want to take advantage of, whether that's analytics or forecasting or some of that consulting work on path to victory analysis, on mapping, on data visualization. We recently increased our offerings to have engagement solutions, which includes small dollar fundraising over the phone. So we have a whole arm of our company now that does small dollar fundraising that some of our larger customers might be interested in investing in as well to juice their fundraising.
Can you explain that? What are you selling there exactly? And is that sort of in the same world as grassroots analytics, say, or some of the firms that sell cell phones for fundraising, or what are you talking about there?
This is more of a service. We have a remote workforce of like, I think 200 agents that do direct to consumer telemarket fundraising. So small dollar fundraising for—
Based on your data?
Yeah, it would certainly be baked on our data, right? Like that would be the starting point for the phone call. But for, you know, organizations contract with us to say, hey, like go raise us money for this large NGO or for a party committee based on this script that is the appeal. And that's a newer line of business for Target Smart. It's only a couple years old. So that's one of the newer pieces of business that we're doing. And then I'd say the other really exciting thing at Target Smart is our new media buying platform, where we have we've built what's called a demand side platform for digital advertising that's based on Target Smart's data. It's incredibly cool. This ad tech exists in the space, but this is one that's like by Democrats for Democrats. From my perspective, you know, we can do a poll and call out a target audience in the poll and say, hey, we find that, you know, the top third of our turnout score and the middle third of our partisanship score are the people who are the most likely to move in our poll. And we can walk that audience over to a universe of 30,000 voters in this district. And then we can serve those 30,000 voters digital ads directly. Based on this, the transparency that's available in our new media buying platform, we can know exactly who got served the ads. And we can see exactly how much the actual bid went for. We get the logs back, which is really kind of— ad tech's kind of above my head, but I've seen a couple of demos on this stuff and it's incredible. It's kind of revolutionary for our business, I would say. One of our big kind of pushes this year and one of the new entrees that we're making into the space. And I think it's kind of part and parcel to what I'm selling, which is we've got public opinion research services that you can tie to actual decisions you're going to make with your campaign to help you go and win, which I think is an important value proposition that sets us apart in the polling space, but certainly sets Target Smart apart in the broader Democratic tech ecosystem.
Sounds like you're happy where you are. You're going to be there a while. What would you like to see the polling part of Target Smart turn into over the next 5 to 10 years?
I think that we have opportunities to grow and take on newer and larger customers. Right now, I'm kind of the rate limiter on our team to some extent. I'm the one quote unquote principal on the team. And so I tend to be the cog in the works for figuring out our ability to do more. So more bends would be a really cool next place for us to go. Partners in crime who are taking on their own book of business and bringing their own network to our team so that we can continue to grow our broader team skill sets and reach into new markets and new networks, different types of client work. So I think that's a really exciting growth opportunity for us. We're going to continue to be on the forefront of how this industry is innovating. We work for a technology company, so we're going to continue to lean into the tech and how it's harder and harder to reach people, but we've got the tools at our disposal to figure it out and to experiment and to do what's work, like kind of go with what's working and toss aside the things that aren't working. For a hot minute there, we were doing a lot of email solicitation for our polls, and it worked for about 6 months, and then it just stopped working, where we just started seeing terrible delivery rates on the emails. For a while, the emails were getting through, and then they just stopped getting through, and that was adjustments that the email service providers were making. We're constantly kind of keeping up with the new innovations on the technology side. The mobile device is the thing that we're really leaning into, but there's all kinds of tech that's also a challenge there. People screen their calls to a higher extent than they ever have before. There's sometimes technology that allows them to not even get the call in the first place if it doesn't come from a number they recognize. We're going to kind of keep figuring this out and how we can continue to do meaningful research in ways that continues to listen to people at scale with empathy and helps use that information to translate into good decision-making for folks that are running program.
I had heard that Tom Bonier, who you've mentioned a couple times, had moved to the parent company and you had a new CEO at Target Smart. Anything changed? Tell me about that transition.
Yeah, Lindsay Shue Cortez is our new CEO. She's fabulous. We just started working with her about six-ish months ago when she took the helm. Tom and Lindsay definitely have different leadership styles. I don't want to like comment on trade secrets or anything like that. Lindsay has brought a perspective of she comes out of the labor movement. She comes out of some startup space, right? She was the first CEO of the Democratic Data Exchange. And so she's seen how our data interacts in the space in a really acute way and has some really, and she was also the CEO at Blue Labs for a number of years. So she's kind of seen how our data permeates the space in lots of different ways and has a really unique perspective on that. She's being thoughtful about how we can continue to expand on what we've done well and continue to grow into new spaces that is really exciting. And she and Tom just have a very different affect, I would say. They're both lovely, lovely people and really kind and empathetic. And neither of them is a micromanager. And I think like that continues to be our ethos and what credentials us well. They both have the kind of Target Smart vibe of generally being kind and nice, which is one of the reasons I've been at the company for so long, which is, am I allowed to curse?
Yeah.
All right. So my first interview with Tom, he told me we don't hire assholes. I tell people that like almost every interview I do with people I'm thinking about hiring. And I think it's like a really simple idea. A lot of really great things flow from that, from a company culture perspective, that if everyone's kind of there and assumes good intentions and is kind to one another, our work is really hard. It's taxing. The stakes are really high. Everyone cares about the outcomes of our work in a really profound way. All of those things can make a workplace really stressful. And while we certainly have our stresses, I think we handle it really well because we don't hire assholes. And the people that come to this company tend to like each other. They tend to work well together and they tend to bring, you know, their best selves to work and deal with each other in kind of kind and empathetic ways. And I think that's a unique culture that's hard to replicate and one that I just tremendously appreciate. I know that Lindsay espouses like 100%.
Is there something, Ben, I should have asked you that I failed to?
We didn't talk about how the media covers polling.
We didn't. I don't think it covers polling real well, do you?
No. No. It's like the one thing I get on a soapbox about. No, it's terrible. It's really frustrating.
What's your central objection?
My central objection is that they're doing exactly what they are incentivized to do, right? Which is create engagement and basically sports out of politics as opposed to covering it. That's just their profit incentive structure, right? The media profits on clicks and subscriptions and ad revenue that's getting eyes on their stories. And they get that by promoting conflict, right?
If you were going to write a story for the Washington Post about the state of polling in the presidential right now, or the state of the race, or like, what would you want them to write if you were going to write it for them, or if you were going to advise them? What do you think would be a useful application of polling to the understanding of the citizenry?
I think I would focus far less on who's winning and who's losing at any given moment in time. And almost anything else would be more interesting and of more value to the public and the readers of their publications. Anything that gets a little bit deeper on how people are understanding the civic world and how government interacts with their lives or doesn't. Anything that gets a little bit deeper on how public policy can and should change the way they walk the world, I think would be much more interesting than who's winning and who's losing at any given moment in time.
Do you think there's something that you understand about public opinion that's broadly not understood right now?
I think I kind of mentioned it a few minutes ago, which is just like the chasm between caring about this stuff and not caring about this stuff is the true divide in American politics. We have obviously a hugely polarized electorate where people are in their DNR camps and they feel that viscerally and emotionally. But we also have a huge block of people that are not ever really thinking about politics. Yeah, I've heard a lot of smart people recently talk about this, and in terms of like that, those are the people who are going to decide this election, are the people who are not engaged and probably won't be engaged for some time. Recognizing that and kind of like easing up a little bit on the world is burning down narrative, particularly in Democratic spaces, would be really wise. This election has barely even started. It really hasn't started yet. We've got a lot of political reporters who want to cover a four-year election cycle when really the election doesn't, for a presidential election, it's like the last 2 months, 3 months are really when the election's happening for the people who are going to determine the outcome. Easing up a little bit on every little moment and how that's going to impact the election in November, I think the time would be much better spent like understanding how people are thinking about the decisions that the people who are elected now are making, and how those decisions are actually going to have an impact on people's lives would be a much better use of their bandwidth. I don't think I'm going to get my wish, but I can grouse about it and I can complain about salacious headlines.
And you just did. Well, great to talk to you. Anything else you want to say?
No, I really appreciate the opportunity. This is great.
Okay. I enjoyed it. That was Ben Lazarus. He is at targetsmart.com. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found. The Great Battlefield is now part of the Democracy Group Podcast Network. Visit democracygroup.org to learn more about other podcasts that cover democracy and civic engagement. You can also help me by leaving comments and good ratings on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere, and by sending me suggestions for great guests to nperlman@gmail.com.